Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Hi. Welcome to the Ouch Talk Show. It's very much a disability thing. I'm Kate Monaghan.
And I'm Simon Minty. We are disabled and we chat about impairment-related stuff with guests who also happen to be disabled.
Usually. Sometimes we have people who aren't disabled.
That's a good point.
Yeah. But, I mean, chat's always about disability because that's why we're here.
Get on with it. Christmas.
Sorry, Christmas. How was your Christmas, Simon?
It was very good. Yeah? I went to the performance of E.T. with a live orchestra.
Lush, at the Albert Hall.
Yeah, and I realised that's where this show comes from. Ouch. Yeah, do you think that could be it?
Ouch. Yeah, I like it. I like it. I went to the Jurassic Park one in November. That was really good.
There's something special about the live orchestra.
Yeah.
And I went with my friend's children, and he's about 7 or 8, and about halfway through, obviously, I started crying because E.T.'s quite emotional.
Yeah.
And I went, and he looked up and went, "You're right." And I got a bit embarrassed.
Aww. Did the kids cry? No, just you.
No, they didn't, but they loved it, and they started cheering, and I was just so chuffed. You know when you take a child to something, and they love it too, and you're going to... And, you know, it's a 35-year-old film.
Yeah.
There's no phones or anything in it. Mobile phones, I mean.
Yeah, because E.T. does phone home.
Yes. Ouch. That should be the new...
But was Christmas generally good?
It was very lovely. You?
Yeah, we had a really nice Christmas. Scout's first Christmas. It was excellent.
Of course.
Yeah, it was really nice.
It is about the children, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And my parents looked after Scout a lot, which gave us a lot of rest.
I started getting a bit nervous turning on the radio or the news because you just hear about another famous person who died. And it continued over Christmas, like non-stop.
Yeah, first of all...
Well...
Who was first, actually?
Carrie Fisher, didn't she? No, George Michael, on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
He lived about a mile away from me, so I made a little pilgrimage, it sounds a bit fancy, up to his house.
And what was there? Were there people there? Was there
lots of people. It wasn't quite Princess Diana scale, but there was loads and loads of flowers all outside and people. And it was very quiet, just really respectful. It was quite sweet, but quite sad.
I bet they didn't have a tribute like... You know, our tribute, like back in the day on Ouch, our predecessor Matt Fraser reminded us on Twitter of an interview that he and Liz did on the talk show in 2008 with the now disbanded learning disabled punk band Heavy Load, and that featured their unique ode to George Michael, which we can have a listen to now, actually.
Can we sing along?
Can I sing along?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
That's so cool.
I wonder if he ever heard that. I really hope he did.
If I'd known, I'd have sung it outside his house as a little tribute. Okay, back to the present. Comedian Lost Voice Guy and student Ginny Butcher will talk about independence and striking out as a disabled young person in 25 minutes or so.
Mohammed Salim Patel is in Salford. Hi, Salim. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
He's also known as the blind journalist, and Salim's doing the social media update for us shortly. But he's also on the BBC's journalism trainee scheme. What is that, Salim, and are you enjoying it?
I'm definitely enjoying it. It's an 11-month contract with the BBC, and as part of the contract, you're given several placements so that you can basically become a multimedia, multi-platform journalist at the end of it.
It's not a disability thing, Salim. It's just a mainstream one?
It's a mainstream scheme, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
OK, well, let's start with Katie Cook. She joins us down the line from Dublin. Hi there, Katie.
Hiya, how are you?
Very good, and how are you?
I'm all right, yeah.
Now, you have 12 to 15 epileptic seizures every day of the falling down, losing consciousness variety. You're also a long-distance runner, and you came first in the ladies' under-19s group at last year's Dublin City Marathon. We discovered you on a radio documentary, which Kate and I had a little listen to. This is quite a remarkable documentary. So here's a clip, and this is where you have a seizure during a race.
Yeah. Okay, what's her name?
Katie, she's not going to hear you yet. She's not coming around yet. Oh, there she is.
Well done, Katie. Oh. To jelly, you jelly baby?
No, I'm okay.
All right,
I'm okay.
Good girl.
To run.
It's good to go.
Thank you so much.
No way, she's gonna stop, not going to stop her finishing
well
now.
Thank you.
Okay, three quarters of a mile to go. You okay?
Yeah.
So who's that brutal trainer with you there telling, come on, you're going, you're doing?
You've had a seizure, up you get, off you go.
It's my doctor, Colin Doherty.
Do you get pulled out of races by paramedics?
Yeah, like all the time. Like that's one of the reasons why me and Colin started training together. Before we did, I was pulled out of every race I entered into. They weren't having any of it. They wouldn't want to listen to what I had to say. Like, no, that's it. I'm the paramedic. You're out.
And we've got your neurologist, Colin Doherty. Are you on the phone there, Colin?
I am.
So,
hi, Colin.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
I'm good.
So as well as being Katie's neurologist, you're actually Katie's running partner, Colin.
Well, for the marathons, yes. And some of the longer distances.
How did that come about, Colin? Because I can't imagine my consultant saying to me, oh, let's go out for a jog together.
I was trying to remember this. Katie, you probably are better.
I do remember. We were sitting in the small little porta cabin. And
that's my clinic in the hospital.
Okay, yeah. Not just a random porta cabin. Good to know. Good.
Katie takes every opportunity to tell how bad the facilities we work in are, which is great. Very helpful for me.
They're atrocious. Honestly, they're atrocious.
So you're in your terrible porta cabin, yeah?
Yeah, and somehow I'd weaved into the conversation that I was doing certain races. I'd just done the 10K for the women's. And I think I told him with the seizures that I was pulled out that the paramedics wouldn't let me continue. That's when Colin suggested, well, maybe we could see if we could run together.
My only role, I mean, I'm a specialist in epilepsy. I've been working in epilepsy for 20 years. But my physical role with running with Katie is to stop people taking her off to an ambulance. You know, I just stand there and I say, no, Katie's fine. I'm her doctor. She's going to recover now. She stands up. Everybody's very well-meaning, but people immediately think that Katie needs to be, you know, brought off to hospital.
But I really like that, that sort of lack of fuss. And it was also your friends did the same with you, Katie. That's like when she's down, we just sort of hang up on any 999 calls, then just play on apps while she's having a seizure. And you're like, oh my goodness me.
So, Colin, is running partnering a service you offer to all your patients? Is there something?
Well, in fact, so as it turns out, this year we had two other epilepsy runners running with the group. We had a group of about eight.
I thought we'd be synchronizing seizing along the way. Like, I full on thought I'd have a seizure, then they'd have a seizure, Colin would be dealing with both of us at the same time.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, I mean, obviously the discussion here revolves around Katie's a remarkable young woman, not just because she, you know, can run marathons, which in and of itself is an exceptional ability at her age. But, you know, she just has so many seizures in any one day. The other people who ran with us would have had more conventional epilepsy. One of them has been seizure. He runs now. He's been seizure-free for several years. And another of our runners would have a seizure maybe every 6 weeks. These would be much more conventional types of epilepsy. Katie's obviously just out there on the spectrum. So I wasn't expecting these others to have seizures.
Colin, tell me about epilepsy and running. Is it generally a good thing for people with epilepsy to run? I can't get my head around this.
There's no more medication. Let's just get out running.
Yeah, just about. Send everyone off for a jog.
Well, in general, it's hard to imagine a condition or disease that somebody has that running wouldn't help. If you took the average long distance runner and measured all of their health parameters against somebody who didn't run, you would find no matter what disease or disorder they carried with them, they're better off. So there are particular challenges, obviously, with having epilepsy and running, especially long distances, particularly when training. And I like to put this out of my mind when I think of Katie running down little country lanes when she runs her long distances. But that means if you're walking, you have those challenges. If you're cycling, you have those challenges. People who have lots of seizures are restricted in their driving by legal terms. But in pretty much every other activity, they have to get on with it. Running is no different. And I think the general benefits to health outweigh these risks.
So clearly running is a good thing because you wouldn't be doing it. I mean, how does it?
Like, yeah, it definitely helps, like, my mindset and my mental functioning.
So it's not necessarily helping epilepsy, but it is your sort of general well-being, you think, is there?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how did you get into running then? How did you decide one day I'm going to run and not worry about whether I have a seizure or not?
I used to be in a wheelchair. I was in it for about 7 months. And that combination with being a very stubborn person, I kind of wanted to prove to people what I could do.
So why were you in a wheelchair?
So I was in Crumlin for a very long time, about 9 months, 10 months.
That's a kid children's hospital?
Yeah, and I'd gone through a lot of drug trials, which kind of took a toll on me. I've been through about 9 drug trials that didn't go very well for, like, epileptic drugs. And I lost all control of my trunk. So I couldn't hold myself up, I couldn't hold my hip up, and in result, I was in a wheelchair.
Your trunk being your kind of upper body?
Yeah, so it was my back and your 2 hip bones.
How did you go from there to running then?
A lot of physio. But about a year and a half later, I kind of got back into exercise. And even before the whole thing happened, I did always love running. I loved sports. I was a water skier since I was 4 up until I was about 13. And I guess I just started jogging every day, and then that turned into running. And I started to absolutely love the freedom it gave me.
You run marathons and half marathons and stuff. But during the race, you fall down, have seizures, and then you get straight back up again and go.
Yeah.
How do you not hurt yourself when you're falling down? How do you get back up?
Can I jump in? Do you have a warning sign? So how long do you get before it kind of kicks off?
To answer the question about the warning signs first, I do. But it depends. Like, really, I wouldn't get them all the time. Usually, my body would kick in with a warning sign if I was in a dangerous situation, like holding a baby or on stairs or crossing the road. But not always. You know, like, in the marathon, I think I only got 3 or 4 warning signs where I had about 7 seizures. To answer the question about hurting myself, yeah. I've never broken a bone, which I've absolutely been blessed with. But I'm covered in bruises. It's where my mother beats me.
So you just fall down in the middle of the race, and then what happens at that point, and how the heck do you get back
up? Recovery,
yeah, because I always thought people were exhausted after seizures.
Yeah, like, I've also been blessed with that as well, I guess. Like, I'm not tired afterwards. I don't need a rest. It really just depends on the seizure, but my day-to-day seizures, I wouldn't be exhausted after them. I don't have this kind of slowing down of my brain where I'm able to get up and continue what I'm doing. But on certain days, where if I've had an awful day, like, I would get it and I would have to go to bed.
Colin, why does that happen for her?
There's just different, certain forms of epilepsy that have a very rapid return to normal consciousness, and they don't have any of what this feeling of what's called postictal drowsiness. And a lot of patients will recognise this. They have a seizure, even a small one, and they will feel drowsy and tired and want to sleep for, you know, several minutes to hours after the event. But there are other forms of epilepsy, particularly what we call frontal lobe epilepsies, where patients come directly back to consciousness immediately. This is the form that Casey has.
In a nutshell, how many variations are there of epilepsy?
What is epilepsy?
Sorry, there's just so many variations, the reason why I laughed.
Okay, it's an hour show, if you can.
Yeah, the best explanation, I think, for a general audience for epilepsy is to say the following. Brain consists of somewhere in the region of about 3 billion cells. And all of these cells are active. But what's fascinating about the brain is that they are desynchronized. What I mean by that is they don't fire together. So as we're having a conversation here, you're listening to me, you know, you might be thinking about what the next item is. Katie's thinking about, when's this guy going to stop talking? There's other thoughts going through your head. Obviously, when we're moving, we're also using the brain for various signals. And they all happen at very, very tiny, distinct rates. And it's a desynchronized machine. So when you look at brainwave activity, it all looks disorganized. The danger and the signature of epilepsy is that the cells start firing together in a synchronized way. Now, if 100 cells fire together, that doesn't do anything. If 1,000 cells fire together, if 100,000 cells fire together, it doesn't do anything. But if 1,000,000 cells fire together, then that causes change in behavior. And when the whole of those 3 billion cells fire together, then you've got a convulsion or a fit, as people recognize it. So this synchronized firing is essentially what epilepsy is. And the reason there are so many different types is largely to do, first of all, I mean, anybody, you don't have to be a physician to know that some epilepsies consist of a person just staring, going blank. Some consist of a person wandering around in a confused way, and others consist of this falling down convulsion. So obviously there are different forms. And then within that, there are different causes for each of those. So it ends up being somewhere in the region of 40 different distinct types of epilepsy.
Mm-hmm.
And Katie has this one form that recovers quickly.
I'm trying to think of me growing up, which is quite some time ago, and people I knew who had epilepsy, but people used to be hospitalised or have to wear helmets and stuff. I mean, this is so much cooler than what you're doing. Is it? I mean, it must be huge and something you've got to manage, but it sounds like you have some freedom, relative freedom.
Yeah, I'm very lucky the way my mother is that she knows what I need. A lot of that is freedom. There are certain things she does want me to do, like not go on stairs. She wants me to wear a helmet, but I've insisted that I'm absolutely not going to look like a bicycle. I'm very lucky that my mother gives me that independence.
Katie, you didn't always have epilepsy. How old were you when it started?
I was 9 years old. I was diagnosed, but I think I started having them when I was about 8. They were never this bad, though. It was really when I'd went into teenage years, like my hormones started kicking up, and that's when things kind of went downhill.
Is that a usual trigger then, hormones creating epilepsy?
I'll let Colin answer that one, I have no idea.
There's a form of epilepsy which is known as catamenial epilepsy, which is a very specific form of epilepsy where there's a direct relationship between hormonal change and the seizures.
Wow.
Beyond that, though, most women who have epilepsy will often attest to the fact that they're more likely to get a seizure around the time of both ovulation and of their period. So yeah.
God,
it's
as
not,
if that
not
isn't
well
bad
understood.
Enough. As if periods
are bad
enough.
I know,
it's
like, I'm being punished enough. It's like, I don't need this right now. Thank you.
Exactly. Katie, you have about 10 violent seizures every night. We've got a clip here of what happened when you recorded them for your documentary. Let's have a listen. How did it feel when you listen to that back?
I had a feeling you'd ask that question. I've been asked that before, and I guess, like, I don't really have a response to it because, like, obviously I've been told what I say or what I do during them. But it is, if I was anyone else, a little bit terrifying. But because I'm so used to it, I guess I don't really have much to say about it.
Can I ask you something
a
bit personal?
We've both got questions. Come on.
Yeah, of course.
Now, you've got a boyfriend. What are night times like in your house when he stays over?
Is your mum with you, Katie?
Yeah, but maybe mum and doctor, close your ears. What was his response when you first stayed the night?
Did he take credit?
He happens to stay quite a lot, like, in our house. Like, he stays about 2 nights a week. He's, like, one of the most chill person I know. Like, he sleeps through them, which is a bit weird.
Whoa, that's impressive.
Yeah, isn't it? Like, I'd slap him in the face during seizures. Wow. And, like, I talk in my sleep as well, and I snore and I kick on top of seizures. So I'm very, very lucky, to be honest.
So he's a deep sleeper. I get ratty if people sort of roll about and
snoring.
Oh, man. But...
Like, he wakes up maybe for the odd one, because I do have quite violent ones, but... Like, he kind of just falls back asleep then.
And if, again, this is a very personal question, but if they're affected by hormones, are they affected by other things that people in relationship do around bedtime? Does that trigger them? Does
you mean
that
like
get
reading
in the
a book?
Way? Bit like reading
no,
a book.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't, no.
It doesn't. So you've never had any issues with that?
I have had issues with that, but it doesn't, like, trigger them.
Excellent. Good to know.
Listening to you, yes, it can be a bit terrifying, but also that's because we're not used to it. But it also made the documentary very powerful. My question was, at what point do you have consciousness and not have consciousness? So that bit we listened to there, are you aware of that when that's happening, or are you in a different place at that point?
Mostly I'm in a completely different world.
Right.
But it depends on the seizure. Sometimes I'm completely aware, I'm just utterly paralysed and I can't move or I can't do anything and I just have to roll with it until it's over. Sometimes I'm absolutely not. I'll wake up on the floor and be like, okay, why am I on the floor? Did I just fall over?
10 violent seizures every night. You must be awake a lot.
Yeah,
you must be...
I don't sleep.
Yeah, so how did you cope with school, with college?
Exams.
Exams,
I didn't.
Yeah.
I was completely sick from third to almost fifth year. So for the Leaving Cert, I managed to do the whole curriculum in just sixth year with the home tutor. I didn't manage to get into school in the mornings because I'm non-functioning, mostly. If I have a bad night, like, there's a fat chance of getting up in the morning.
I found that, obviously, my condition is very different to yours. I've got a type of arthritis, and I had chronic pain and therefore chronic fatigue, and school was a nightmare.
I'm the same.
But I had lots of sort of reasonable adjustments put in place for exams and things. I had a long time to do exams. I could get up, lie down, have a nap if I needed to. Did you get those kinds of adjustments?
No, I didn't. I did get what was called extra hours, but what these extra hours were, if I had a seizure, I could, you know, like, take time out for that and then go straight back to it. I didn't have for the actual exam, quote unquote, extra hours.
And that's really tough. I mean, is that because they didn't know, you didn't ask? It's kind of, that's quite pivotal.
Oh, like, my mom tried so hard. I don't know whatever way the system runs, but, like, she applied and applied and paperwork and applied. I wasn't granted it. I was given, like, a separate room, and I was given, again, quote-unquote, extra time and an SNA, but, like, as far as other help goes, I didn't get it.
And we're only talking a couple of years ago. You're still relatively young.
Yeah, who? No, I'm not.
Me?
Yeah, so.
Thanks for saying that. I am relatively young. No, mine was a little while ago.
And where are you studying at college now?
I am.
What are you studying?
Fitness and leisure management.
And does that involve doing lots of different sports then?
Not as much sports, more kind of like gym stuff, like gym instruction. So we'd be doing a lot of weights and then like a bit of cardio and stuff. We also have life-saving incorporated, and on Tuesdays we're in the pool.
All I can imagine now is you having a seizure in the pool and drowning, or you lifting
weights in the
gym.
Which is ironic because I'm training to be a lifeguard. So
you're training to be a lifeguard.
I am. That's part of our course.
Wow.
So.
Colin and Katie, as we're being public service, what tips would you give to people with epilepsy? Swimming and running?
I wouldn't give swimming, to be honest. I don't want to, like, you know, do that to people with epilepsy. It's just kind of me as a person who likes to push the boundaries, as you probably can tell.
Yes.
But no, I would probably not advise someone with seizures, and especially frequent ones, to get in a pool and swim out.
Colin, do you have any tips for people with epilepsy?
I just listened to the conversation there. I mean, I'm sure, and this is presumably part of the remit of your programme here, you know, the modern treatment of chronic conditions, I suppose, is that we need to facilitate people to live as normal a life as possible, and they need to be encouraged to do everything, that, you know, express themselves in as wide a way as possible. There are some legal restrictions around epilepsy. I mean, you know, if you've had a seizure, you can never be a pilot. If you've had a seizure, you could probably never drive an articulated truck. But
hey, Colin, I
want
to be a pilot.
I know. I knew you'd say that.
Colin, co-pilot.
Yeah, yeah. Colin the co-pilot.
Oh, my God, Colin, let's do it.
So your general idea is basically trying to keep people living their lives, and you're saying to people, go and do it as much as you possibly can
whilst keeping
yourself safe.
Absolutely. Swimming is a good example. We would use what's called a buddy system in swimming. So the idea is that you would always go with somebody who knew your condition, because obviously somebody having a seizure in the water could look like somebody, you know, play acting, or so long as the person with you knows, and then within reason, if you're a strong swimmer, you would still swim such that any rescue attempt would be doable, would be possible. Mm-hmm. But my attitude is generally to try and overcome all these barriers. And the biggest barrier, I have to tell you, is not the safety issue. The biggest barrier is the perceptions of other people.
I would agree with that.
Well, that was absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming on and chatting to us. Thank you, Colin and Katie. There'll be a link to Katie's powerful documentary, No Time to Lose, on our podcast page. You can find all the information, as usual, on bbc.co.uk/ouch.
Take a listen to this. Love you so much, I could die for you. Boy, you know I'm never gonna lie to you. I could never let you down. No, 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 no. Boy, you say you love me. And that's Lioness Oyimbo. Hear more of that track, Low Low, at the end of the show.
I like that.
Yeah, it was all right, wasn't it? We were getting into it.
I was getting into it. I can't wait for a little bop to that when we finish. Salim, what have disabled people been talking about on the internet this month?
Well, they've been talking about a lot, really. And the first story I'm going to start talking about today is a recent one. And it relates to Anne Wafula Strike, who's a 47-year-old Paralympian wheelchair racer. And the reason why she's been in the news is because on the 8th of December, she was on a 3-hour cross-country service from Nuneaton to Stansted. Now, Anne felt that she needed to use the toilet. So she made her way to the disabled toilet on board the train, but found that it was boarded up and had an out-of-order sign on it. So she contacted the ticketmaster and explained that, you know, she needed to use the bathroom and obviously the toilet wasn't available. She says that the ticketmaster was quite sympathetic and she said that, you know, we'd wait for the next station to arrive, they'd get her off and, you know, she'd be able to use the bathroom and then they'd put her back on the service. However, the stop that they did come to unfortunately had no staff at the platform, so she was left having to wait on the train. And the next stop would have been Peterborough, but sadly Anne felt that, you know, she needed to use the bathroom and had no choice but to, and this is what she said, I wet myself. And as a result of that, she's been left humiliated and she feels, you know, violated as well. So that was in the news because Anne decided to go public. As a response to Anne's experience, Cross Country did respond and they did apologise to Anne and they said that, you know, the reason why that train was in service was because the trains which did have a disabled toilet were out of service because of cow strikes and there was a door defect on that train that she was on. They have
what strikes?
Yeah, cow strikes. Yeah.
So what, cows had hit the trains?
Yeah, they'd managed to veer onto the tracks and unfortunately got hit by a train. So
I can't imagine how that must feel to, you know, be in a position where you aren't able to access a toilet and actually wet yourself on a train. Like it is. That is unbearably bad.
And also, she's actually gone public with it.
So rightly so.
The reason why she's decided to do that is because she felt if I stay quiet, then what awareness is going to be put out there? And I mean, this article itself has been shared on Facebook and Twitter by loads of people because actually, on the day that the article was released, I saw on my own personal Facebook feed 3 people complaining about rail assistance itself, and that's where disabled people have the option to book a train station staff member to assist them in whatever way they need at each station for their journey when they're alighting onto a service. But people have found and people have been complaining and saying in kind of regular discussion threads that I see on Facebook that often rail assistance isn't provided despite people booking them in advance.
I have to say I'm almost bored of hearing about rail assistance being bad because it is bad so often.
Yeah.
And I've heard about it so often. This was sort of an extreme of it, which I think should have been talked about. But I just feel like anybody complaining about the railways as a disabled person, it washes over me because I just hear it so much. I've had so many experiences of being left on a train, not being able to get off, just no, you know, lifts not working, and it just never changes.
And you can't get angry because
I'm over being angry about it.
But presumably then this is down to the rail operators, and why are they not taking it? So, I mean, because you will get times where the loo or the lift or whatever it is out of order, we know that. But there was no alternative. That's where it kind of really fell down.
And the other thing with this situation was Anne says that she wasn't informed in advance of the actual service not having a disabled toilet. Mm. So, you know, she had no choice. If she would have probably known, she may well have, you know, gone before boarding the service or whatever. But I completely agree with you in the sense that it is boring because I've experienced the same. You actually spend half the time on the train panicking, thinking, is the assistance going to work this time?
Yeah, exactly.
And, that's, you know, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
It's a case of it's there, it's meant to assist disabled people, but it's not coming to fruition.
Well, it's one of those times we have to kind of hand it over a little bit.
Yeah.
And so then when it fails, it's really frustrating. But I read the article, and the bit at the end which kind of got me even more was she said, I then sprayed perfume on me because I didn't want to smell. Because she still had to continue the journey. You're thinking, this is so humiliating. And
it's unbearable.
I mean, she had no choice, I guess, but
Yeah.
It gets to a stage where you think, should I even bother complaining again? Because
exactly,
you just
that's
get the
thing.
Generic response.
Yeah,
that is it.
Yeah.
No, we can't do that. We've got to ramp it up.
Yeah.
I don't know, because it feels like nothing ever changes. So I had to come to the point. I mean, and obviously I've never had anything as bad as what Anne went through. But even just in my small way, I got to the point where I have to forget and be zen about this, because otherwise I will spend my life being angry at train companies.
I think the problem that they don't realise as well is travelling independently for a disabled person is a big step.
Yeah.
And when the facilities in place that should help you don't come through, it's like that whole confidence just flops, doesn't it? So.
But we do have to remember that there is not a representative from the train company to put their side of the story, and I'm sure they'd have a side of the story, but so this is a very one-sided.
Things if they visited, we'd have to tell them that they lose out of order.
All lose ever for the 10 hours they're in our studio. Salim, what's your next story? Something about a smartphone app?
It is, yes. It's called Identify, and that's spelled with an I at the end instead of a Y. And it's an iPhone app, sadly only available on iPhone. But it's basically an object recognition app, and it's new on the market. I actually came across it on Facebook through a sponsored suggested app. And I found this quite recently, where a lot of the suggested apps and things like that come up on your feed are now more related to disability.
Okay.
And this app itself, it's like I said, it's an object recognition app, and it's really user-friendly. The interface itself is...
What is an object recognition app?
It's for blind and partially sighted people, and they basically use their camera on their phone to take a picture of an object in front of them, and that basically gives you a description of what it is. So I could take a picture of a bottle of tomato ketchup, and at the time I won't know it's tomato ketchup, but I'll take a picture and it'll say, hopefully it will say, you know, red bottle of tomato ketchup.
Okay, so I've got, there's that well-known search engine, and that you can back up all your photos with them, and then they start grouping them. So these are all the photos with a bottle of beer, all the photos with a bottle of tomato ketchup. This is the software, clearly, that they're using in different apps now.
Yeah, it's almost artificial intelligence. I mean, on Facebook recently, they had the AI where it recognised photos that people had put up. So it'd say something like, picture of two people smiling, close up. It's similar to that, but with this app, you're basically able to use it for both object recognition but text recognition. So you can take a picture of an article or a letter and it will read it out to you.
Well, that's interesting.
And, I mean, there are other apps out there, such as Be My Eyes and Tap Tap See.
Yeah.
But in my opinion, I think the way that this app has been put together, it's the detail of the description is so much better.
But, Salim, your point, which we're loving the app already, but your point was this: you were being marketed to around your specific impairment type, and this was quite new.
Are you saying you actually like the ads on Facebook? Is that what you're telling me now? You're happy that they're there?
I am. I actually am.
I think that's the first time I've ever heard anyone say that, ever.
Well, the thing is, if it wasn't there, I'd never have known about this app. So it's like, it's targeted to me as a disabled person. And I put a post out on Facebook just asking people generally, you know, what do you think about these targeted apps? And some people said, yeah, it's really good. They agreed with kind of my viewpoint. But then there was others that said, well, how does Facebook even know that I've got a disability? Or isn't that a privacy breach? Things like that.
I think, yeah, but that privacy thing, did you write to a friend recently saying, you know what, I wish there was an app that could recognise bottles of tomato ketchup, and then suddenly, I mean, I write to friends and say, I want these new pair of shoes, and suddenly that advert will appear on my timeline.
Yeah, well, I think the way that this has come about is, Be My Eyes is actually, you can sign in through Facebook, as you can do with a lot of apps, and I think that probably in the system somewhere recognises that, OK, this person may be blind or partially sighted because he's using this app, and then...
So it's not that all your status updates are, I am blind and this has happened today, I am blind and this has happened today.
Yeah. It's an algorithm, probably, and I think it's quite nice.
If it's working for you, would you not think, Kate? Are you still a bit hesitant?
I don't know. I get freaked out that they read my stuff. Maybe. And...
Also, when something's free, you're always paying for it.
Well, exactly. No, but I suppose if it helps me find something that would be super awesome and change my life, then yeah, I would be really happy.
But they need to know more about you. You've got to give some stuff away.
Yeah. I don't know if I want to do
that.
No,
I can tell you're quite private.
Yeah. Good luck with your traineeship. Don't come and steal our jobs, though, OK? We're quite happy with what we're doing. And Salim, you're going to stay with us till the end of the show?
I'm here till the end.
Excellent. That's what we like to hear. Now, having your first drink and learning to drive are two markers of independence for non-disabled young people. Preferably don't do it at the same time. Mm-hmm. But those with impairments often face greater hurdles on their coming-of-age journey.
Ability is disabled comedian Lee Ridley's new radio sitcom, a pilot episode which goes out on Radio 4 on 7th of January. The main character, Matt, played by Lee, has cerebral palsy and speaks through an iPad like Lee does. The show joins Matt as he starts an independent life away from his parents. So in a nutshell, Lee, what's Ability about?
Ability is about a disabled guy who can be a bit of a kid. So it's obviously 100% fictional and not based on myself at all. Matt, who is the main character, has moved away from home and is living with his mate called Jess. He wants to prove to everyone that he can be independent, but it isn't always as easy as he thinks. Matt also has a carer who is called Bob. But, to be honest, he's not very good at it.
Here, Matt's flatmate and best friend is teasing him about the way his synthesised voice says certain words.
Well, we need cash. Maybe you could marry a Kardashian. Like, some kind of Geordie answer to Kim Kardashian's husband.
I know what you're doing.
Say it.
No.
Say it.
No.
Please?
Kanye West.
Sorry, who?
Kim West.
Oh, I love it.
Mr. West, shut your face.
Are there other words that the voice doesn't say very well, Lee?
It can't say lasagne very well either. As in the popular Italian meal. Which is annoying because it's my favourite meal. I've given up trying to order it when I go to an Italian restaurant. Now I just order things the old-fashioned way, by pointing to what I want on the menu and hoping for the best. The problem with pronunciation also means that I can only date girls with names that I can say properly.
Simon, could I ask Lee a question at all?
Of course, Lee.
Yeah, go, Celine.
Lee, the software that you use to kind of read out your answers, how quick does that work? Are you typing it out and then it speaks, or is it kind of preloaded?
We'll have a natural pause while Lee is now typing in the answer. I think you'll find, Celine.
There's my answer as well.
And this, but now I've killed it.
No, you've killed it now, but I think there's a bit of both going on. Let's see.
It's fairly quick, but most of it is preloaded.
There we go. 18-year-old Ginny Butcher is with us. Hi, Ginny.
Hi there.
Now, Ginny uses a wheelchair to get around and a ventilator to breathe. Until earlier this year, Ginny's care needs were met by parents and agency staff. But now she employs three PAs and looks after all her own health stuff. Do you think your life could be turned into a sitcom, Ginny?
Yeah, or maybe a very long and boring book.
Long and boring.
Sort of admin and how to employ people.
Yeah, something like that.
That's a big responsibility.
It's a huge responsibility. So why did you decide to sort of take it all over yourself?
Because it means I can choose who I work with. So I've been able to choose the three ladies that I employ now. Which means I don't have to work with people I don't like or that aren't suitable for me. And it means I can decide what care I have in terms of hours and stuff like that. I don't have to conform to what the agency want to do and stuff like that. So it's much better for me, really.
But extra stress and, are there problems that come with it? Or has it all been plain sailing?
No, it's definitely not plain sailing. There's a lot of stress. So obviously I started doing it in September 2016, when I was 18. So I had to learn how to employ people, I had to learn how to write a contract, how to do taxes, stuff like that, which takes a long time. Mm. Pensions, it's all a bit dull for an 18-year-old to do, but I guess the end result is worth it for me because I have a much more independent and relaxed life now.
So. And that kind of closeness of your PA, I can understand that. That stress would disappear with having someone great.
Yeah, absolutely. So they're all fantastic, which makes the job a lot easier.
Lee, in the sitcom, the your character's agency carer is quite dodgy. I mean, is this based on experiences of carers?
Yes. So the character is a mixture of them all, really. Some of the carers that I've had have been wonderful.
Now, Ginny, you...
It always bothered me that the level of care from some...
This is so difficult.
Just one little bit, and I just have to do my disability political head.
Sorry, Lee.
So the tech won't
the tech
work
won't
for
work.
Us.
It's not working. It's so
it's
annoying.
Like these disabled loos on trains. It's always breaking down and all this sort of stuff.
One of the most amusing stories I have is when one of my carers turned up drunk one morning and then ended up falling asleep on the floor. At the time, I didn't quite see the funny side, but as a comedian, it's a great piece of material.
Okay. So, Ginny, you moved from quite structured setup, and now you're managing it yourself, and you're almost kind of, or are you trying to tell social services there's a better way and a different way of doing this?
Yeah, so I think what me and my three PAs have got going on is a really relaxed way of working, where we don't stress about stuff, we're all friends with each other, and, you know, we go out, we party, we chat to each other, we spend time with each other outside of work, we message each other. It's not just about... I think what we're trying to do is show people that it can be less official and less sort of medical and... You know, stop using words like complex moods and stuff like that and start thinking about, you know, shall we go to the cinema or shall we go and, you know, go out for the evening or whatever and, you know, what should we do for my birthday?
I like the principle and I think that's great. And I think we had the stay up late people on one of the earlier shows, which was really cool. My worry, though, Ginny, and I think if I had people around me all like that, would I then become a bit lazy and don't have to go out? Because you're still paying them. So there's a bit of, what about making friends who are outside of that?
And what if they do something that you're not happy with as well and you're too matey-matey and it's a bit of a, can you then say, actually, no, that's not what I wanted you to do?
Yeah, so absolutely. So I have absolute control. If anyone did something I didn't like, then obviously, you know, that would not be acceptable. But I've worked with them for 3 or 4 years. We know each other so well, I... trust they would never do something I didn't like, but obviously there is a chance that that would happen in the future or whenever, and that, you know, we'd sort that out, we'd chat about it, we'd discuss it, and if it was really bad, then the other two PAs would also have my back and say that wasn't good enough or whatever, you know.
I think on that basis it's a case of knowing where you need your help as well. I mean, with support workers, I kind of have that relationship of I guess their mates, but they know when to help me and when not to, and they also know that, listen, I'm in charge, you know. So I think completely agree. It's about building that relationship, and over time it gets stronger, but that professionalism always has to obviously be maintained. So it does work when you do have that authority to get what you want, because only you know what you want. So
absolutely. And you know, I don't like it when people try to tell me what I want. So when, you know, social services and stuff try and tell you what you want, that's not right. You need to, you know, stand up for yourself and say, no, actually, what I want is this, and I'm gonna make it happen, and that's all good. And they all know, like, we're absolutely good friends, but at the same time they know when I want to be left alone or have some alone time or have family time or have friends from uni, you know, stuff like that. So it's good.
So you are making friends outside of as well, you're not being too lazy and just using your PAs, your mates?
No.
Just checking, thanks. And I think you should say it with... I love the way you said that, I have complete control. I think you should say that more often.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's good.
We've got a theme going here. It's all people striking out independent. So, Lee, like your character, you've moved out of your parents' home. What challenges did you come up against without your mum and dad on hand to help?
It was when I went to university that I left home, and it was definitely one of the scariest things I've done. Up until that point, my parents had always been there for me, and then, all of a sudden, I didn't have them to help me out anymore. Because I had a personal assistant to help me with stuff like cooking and cleaning, I guess my main challenge was dealing with the social side of university. Although I had a group of close friends at college, I still felt pretty isolated while I was at home because I lived quite far from all of my mates. So I was very shy when I went to university, and the thought of having to make new friends was the thing that worried me most. Not least because I didn't know how they'd react to my disability. Of course, I was worrying about nothing, and going to university was the best thing I ever did. It just made me so much more independent and integrated into society.
It's just remarkable. I know Lee from stand-up comedy, and it's very strange hearing him being sensible for quite a while.
I know,
but also we can't interrupt him.
No, I find that interesting that Lee really enjoyed it though, because you obviously had a good experience, Lee, whereas my experience of university was pretty rubbish on the whole.
Do you want to talk about it?
No, that's why I pay a therapist, Simon. But no, it was just I just found it quite, like Lee said, very isolating, I think, and I was just so worried about it all.
University for you, Ginny. Lee talked about his experiences.
Yeah, so I'm at Plymouth, and I just started this year, and I really am enjoying it, but obviously I live at home, so it's a bit different from Lee, but yeah, it's all accessible, and it's fantastic, really. It's really fun.
What about when you're getting ready to go to university?
You mean the planning and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Before I went to Plymouth, I had a plan to go somewhere else where I was going to stay. So we were planning all that sort of accommodation. But then my plans changed. I went to Plymouth. So it was all a bit of a roller coaster, really. But it took a long time. In the end, we got there. And the main thing was the care for me, really. It took years. I think I started when I was about 16, something like that.
Well, that is thinking ahead.
And it just takes months and months and months, and there's so much paperwork, and it's just, it's crazy is what it is. It needs to be sorted out. But I guess in the end, it came out all right.
So. The principle's a great one. You employ the people for exactly the reason so you can have the people you want.
Yeah.
But the problem is there's a whole load of admin that goes with that now.
Absolutely.
You have two PAs 24 hours a day in the same house as you and your mum. Does that come with challenges?
Yeah, it does. So, yeah, I live with my mum, but we've kind of split the house a bit so that me and my two PAs / carers can stay down one end. And then we share the kitchen, so it's all a bit... But, you know, she's very good, and she lives with it. And so does my sister, who's home sometimes. She lives with it as well, so... It's okay.
Does she feel a bit like she's not needed? Because if she used to do a lot of your care and now all of a sudden you've taken it over and you've got your own PAs.
And they get paid for it. Your mum never got paid.
Yeah, I know.
Motherly duties and all that. But so now she doesn't have to do any of my care, which is good. But I think at first it felt really strange for her. Mm. And yeah, she didn't really know what to do with herself, but now she can do anything she wants. So.
Lee, tell me, if Ability in the Dream World gets commissioned as a series...
It's going to get a big series.
I really think it's going to get a series.
Yeah.
We got a sneak peek and it is very, very good. What other disability things would you like to cover in the show?
Disabled dating is an obvious one. I think there's a lot of material in that. Similarly, I'd be an idiot if I didn't do something around the way the government has treated disabled people recently. Some of the sitcom really does write itself. But I'd also like to develop some of the other characters a bit more too. I think it'd be nice to see what it's like living with a disabled bloke from the point of view of his flatmate.
Okay, we can't have you on, Lee, without talking about the US comedy Speechless, whose main character, JJ, has cerebral palsy and speaks via a letterboard. It's not on UK TV yet, but I'm guessing you've seen it, and if so, could you relate?
Yes, I've just finished watching it recently, actually. It's pretty funny. I think that I also enjoyed it more because I could relate to the situations better because I've lived them myself. It was also nice to see a disabled person in a main role in a sitcom, especially one who can't speak.
Was there also a twinge when you went, oh, damn it, someone's got there first, or hang on, I want to use that gag?
There were many jokes that were very funny, so that was annoying. But that...
But I got it. They've nicked you. They're using your gags, and it's so annoying when someone gets there before you.
Yeah, that's true. And does it well as well. Because when they do it, they get there before you and do it badly, you feel like you can come in and do it better. But if they do it well, that's even worse.
Lee, we will let you go. The technology is not playing with us both here. Thank you, Lee. Look forward to the show.
Bye.
That's fine. Nice chatting to you. Take care.
Well, thank you very much, Ginny and Salim and
thank you,
Lee. We really appreciate your time. And that's it for the January 2017 Ouch Talk Show. Thanks go to our guests, Katie Cook, Mohammed Salim Patel, Ginny Butcher and Lee Ridley. And thank you to the team, Damon Rose, Beth Rose and producer Emma Tracy. Studio manager was Tansy Leitner.
Music this month is by Lioness Oyinbo, also known as Lynn Martinussen. She's blind from Norway, and Lynn recently won the Trailblazer category of the Nigerian Music Awards for being a foreigner who has had success in that country's pop music scene. This is a track from her upcoming EP. It's called Lolo.
Goodbye.
Like a bullet piercing my heart, I loved you right from the start. The way you move on a dance floor, crazy rhythm and flow. Then you dance over to me, and you whisper softly, baby, lucky to you, wind it low, 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 low. Love you so much, I could die for you. Boy, you know me never gonna lie to you. I could never let you down, oh, no.
I want to plug my show. Ability is on Radio 4, on Saturday the 7th of January, at 11:30 p.m., and afterwards on iPlayer.